better by gun believe it, Roy. This old Gabby Hayes here on the show. Hey, White Aryan Resistance, radio calling. Most of you guys don't remember Gabby Hayes. Probably don't even remember Roy Rogers. In Germany, he was called Roy Rüdiger. Yeah. Hey, it's July the 22nd, 2015, and Wotan's Day. Goes out to David Lane, Wotan's Day. Get your subscription donation money in for the show if you haven't already. Most of you have. And that's 20 smackaroos a month, and we give you all kinds of information. Stuff you need, stuff you can't get from Alex and all those boys, the Jones boys and so forth, yeah. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Beautiful day again today. I was out shopping this morning early. I got two things to do that's important. I had to get a muffler for my truck, and I had to get a some wire for my motor to go up on the roof on my tower and to turn my antennas around. So I was out bright and early doing that. The other day I thought that truck was getting a little loud. I knew it had a little leakage in the crossover pipe. But I said, damn, that's getting really loud. I looked under the truck and the muffler was gone. It took off on me. I've decided that we need a little bit of history that is from the Pessimist Guide to History book. So every day I'm going to read an excerpt from the Pessimist Guide to History. I know you'll enjoy it. The first one today is 18 billion years ago. Yeah, 18 billion years, the Big Bang. The first and the greatest natural catastrophe imaginable was the Big Bang, the cataclysmic event that scientists believe created virtually the entire universe we know today. The true pessimists among us might find it a less than desirable event, as the calamities that follow would never have occurred if it had not been for that Big Bang. While no one knows what really took place, scientists today believe that the universe before the Big Bang was a single, supercooled energy field no bigger than a speck that floated in a dark, limitless vacuum. Then, for some unknown reason, the energy field was disturbed by a random fluctuation. Suddenly, the field started expanding rapidly, then gravity and light and subatomic particles formed from the original energy field. In a fraction of a second, the Big Bang blasted matter and energy outward at incredible speeds, and even today, billions of years later, the universe continues to expand outward. During the cons following the Big Bang, great clouds of gases and dust formed and gradually condensed into galaxies, stars, planets, and everything else we see around us today. But the question is, what's going on? It's expanding. What's the good reason? What's the good logic for it? I guess that's logic that we'll never know, right? So that's our first reading from the book on A Pessimist's Guide to History. We'll have another one tomorrow. Yeah. Well, I'm expecting one of my long-lost siblings to come flying in here tomorrow, so next couple of days you may be getting a canned show from the past. But hang in there, and I'll be back shortly, okay? Well, let's finish up this book about how rotten it used to be. And then we'll get into the book of how, then we'll get into how rotten it's becoming. And then we'll go back to the Pessimist Guide to History. You'll want to go out and hang yourself. Leisure. Whoops, get my microphone over here. Leisure has become a primary component of American life. You can sure as hell say that again. Co-equal with the necessities and not merely a random gratuity of hard work. But less than 100 years ago, it was not even an expectation. In fact, the meaning of leisure was not clearly understood. It wasn't when I was a kid either. My stepfather had the idea that if you weren't working, you were a total lazy slob. You had to be working all the time. That was his work ethic. Tommy, get to work. For the working masses, vacations did not exist. For those above the subsistence level, ideology got in the way. Their imperative of success producing a tireless rhythm of life where relaxation was tantamount to laziness, a cardinal sin in the land of sweat and gold. As Thomas Low Nichols observed, quote, in no country is there so much toilsome, unremitting labor, and none so little of recreation and enjoyment of life, unquote. My father and I used to work for the City Parks Commission here in Warsaw, Indiana. There's quite a few parks around every lake here. And my father, he'd always get up about 5 o'clock, maybe 4:30. And he always had us to work a half an hour before time to go to work was. And we used to argue all the time about that. Get me up, sitting down there half an hour early. Anyhow, that's the way it was around my neck of the woods back in the early 50s. Because leisure did not belong in the American scheme of things, facilities for it were meager, and what did exist tended to appeal to rough and vulgar tastes. Gambling was widespread and crooked, sports unregulated and cruel. Sportsmanship as we practice it today was not understood. Certain cultural pursuits such as theater and music were accessible to the middle-class city dwellers, but their single-minded devotion to making money left little time for renewal in the byways of life. Charles Dudley Warner, who with Mark Twain wrote The Gilded Age, found Americans unfit for leisure because they applied it to it a form of serious energy used to build a railroad. Gambling, in the turn of a card or the roll of the dice, for all or nothing, there was a kind of daring and touched the American spirit. Quote, the lust for work is matched by the lust to gamble, unquote. The affluent risk thousands in comfort. The poor risk bread money on gaming tables in the slum taverns. The gambling fever produced two opposing species. First, there were the predatory card sharks and confidence men who understood human weakness and how to exploit it. Second were the masses, eternally gullible to be lured of something for nothing. Well, that goes on today, doesn't it? Just as much and a lot more than it used to be. It amazes me at all the senior citizens, especially more women, at the gambling halls gambling away all their Social Security money. I see a lot of them are sick and they're dragging around an oxygen bottle and the whole bit. Throughout the nation, these adversaries met in lotteries, over tables, at racetracks, in casinos, cockpits, and the result was nearly always the same. The suckers lost. Like in Vegas, you lose your ass on one side of the street, you go to the other side of the street thinking your luck will change. And it never does. Back in the day when Bone Crusher and I were running around, that's Carl Strait, somebody out there may remember, the one man in the United States that Morris Dees was absolutely in fear of 24 hours a day. But anyhow, Carl had a good friend, and this good friend was a professional gambler. And one year, he'd be living in townhouses with a couple of Corvettes in his garage. And the next year, he'd be living in the slums in a flea bag motel. That's the way professional gambling seems to go. Not for me. If I lose $20 gambling, I cry for a week. That's why I don't go to the gambling halls. I think the maximum I ever gambled was $40. And that hurt me. The best way to gamble is not to gamble, but go to these places and get cheap food, good music a lot of times, like Vegas used to be. It's not so much that way anymore. But you can have a wonderful time for very little money. Just don't gamble. In the turn of a card or the roll of the dice, for all or nothing, there was a kind of daring that touched the American spirit. The lust for work is matched by the lust to gamble. Did I read that? The gambling fever produced two opposing species. First were the predatory card. Wait a minute, I've read this. In 1870, New York had an estimated 2,500 illegal gambling houses. That's a lot. Which produced, as they did elsewhere, crime, degeneracy. And while these are hardly the byproducts one would expect of a leisure activity, it should be remembered that vice can become a pastime for people who had little alternative resources. There's a new comment here. A sucker has no more chance against those fellows than a snowball has on a red-hot stove, unquote. Animal baiting was the favored leisure activity of New York's rougher element. In Kit Burns Sportsman Hall on Water Street, huge gray rats from the waterfront that had been starved for days were set against each other with heavy betting on prospective survivors. Well, that's an idea. Maybe I should start that up. Hunting. Although hunting as a leisure activity did not have the widespread following it does today, the devastation of wildlife was far greater. Hunters engaged in outright butchery, often using the great flocks of birds for mere target practice. Mallard, duck, and pheasant were killed by the thousands in orgies of shooting, and there were countless incidents of hunters never bothering to count their bag, but leaving hundreds of dead birds to rot on the ground. Sports hunters belonged largely to the middle and upper classes, as ordinary citizens had neither the time nor the money to travel to the game-rich areas. It was thought America's supply of wild birds and beasts was inexhaustible, and there were no constraints, legal or otherwise, against killing them. The indiscriminate slaughter deprived future generations of much of its wildlife heritage. In 1870, two herds of buffalo, estimated at 15 million animals, roamed the land. By 1890, they were extinct. Killing for pleasure. They show a picture here of a train with two or three boxcars on the back, or passenger cars, with several guys on top of it, several guys shooting out the windows, and it's called Killing for Pleasure. Train loads of hunters taking part in the extermination of buffalo, which was accomplished with the dispatch of a military campaign, to show you how totally... It's no wonder the Indians wanted to scalp these people. During the 1870s and 1880s, spectator sports provided the urban masses with some relief from the constriction of their surroundings. But as usual, the cost was high. Boxing, baseball, and horse racing became infested with criminal elements to the point where the terms sporting man and gambler became synonymous. Horse racing, a sport that could not exist without wagers, fell into the hands of the gambling syndicates. Race fixing was commonplace. And at the Brighton Racecourse in Brooklyn, the swamp of the American turf, the official timekeeper had an eccentric watch. Baseball had an even more disreputable name. A sports magazine of 1874 observed, quote, "There is no sport now in vogue in which so much fraud prevails as in baseball. Any professional baseball club will throw a game if there's enough money. Horse racing is a pretty safe thing in comparison. It was not until after the formation of the National League in 1876 that the game began to free itself of gambling, bribery, and the operation of illegal pools. Although heroes to the public, the many players who participated in these schemes had earlier been called by the New York Times, quote, worthless, dissipated gladiators, not much above the professional pugilist, unquote. Curiously, notwithstanding the New York Times editorials against boxing, the fights of the period were unlikely to have been fixed, although they were invariably dirty. The early pugilists were brutal yet proud. The rules casual, and the contest did not end until one man had been at least punched, kicked, bitten into bloody unconsciousness. In July 1889 in Richburg, Mississippi, John L. Sullivan took 75 knockdown rounds in a 106-degree heat to defeat Jake Kilrain. The fight lasted 2 hours and 16 minutes. The sport became so murderous that the New York City outlawed it, which did nothing to diminish its popularity as the matches went underground to shady sections of Westchester and Staten Island or on rafts up the Hudson River. In all these spectators' sports, reform eventually had its way. Meanwhile, they provided the Victorian public with a prism through which was accurately refracted the despair of their own lives. Football. Violence as a leisure activity was not a monopoly of the prize ring. It was the only ingredient of college football which seasonally transformed intelligent young men into grunting Neanderthals. Teams from the highest institutes of learning fought each other with a savagery worthy of the street gangs, leading to widespread injuries and great bitterness. The Cornell University team particularly was feared for its aggressiveness, and in 1876 both Harvard and Yale refused to meet it. Not that Yale men were softies. In 1884, they clashed with Princeton in a game that was described in the New York Evening Post. Quote, the spectators could see the 11 hurl themselves together and build themselves into kicking, writhing heaps, unquote. Paul Bourget, the French novelist and critic, attended another game, compared these melees with an intricable knot of serpents with human heads. Often, after these frenzied entanglements, one of the combatants remained on the field motionless, so hard has he been pressed, crushed, and dumped. At such barbaric contests, surgeons seemed just as important as the players. The casualty rate, often 7 players injured out of 20, nearly 33%, was described rightly by F. L. Muirhead as greater than that of the Battle of Bar Harbor, the bloodiest clash of the Civil War. If recreational facilities for adults were limited, they were totally absent for children. In the scheme of things, during the 1860s through the 90s, children simply did not count. City children, especially those from the slums, were virtual prisoners in hostile surroundings. Their playground was the street. Their games, mischief, and vandalism were born of utter boredom, a dull apathy that Jane Addams said smothered the divine fire of youth, unquote. Some broke windows, others smashed street lamps. In a few slum areas, according to Mayor Abraham Hewitt of New York, young people amused themselves in shooting policemen. So I guess nothing has changed. They fought continually. Casual encounters led to quarrels, and before long the youngsters were beating each other in the face, rolling in the gutter like the little animals they are. City authorities provided no space, nor did they leave as much as a single vacant lot as a play area for the young. In 1895, the city of Boston donated 3 sand piles for the use of children, a radical step, and even by 1903, only 18 cities had public playgrounds of any description. Mid-century New York had some open lots where the young played stickball and football. But with new waves of immigrants, these were appropriated for buildings, leading to the incongruity of more children and less playing area. Quite naturally, street games drew numerous complaints of annoyance and property damage from storekeepers, tenants, and pedestrians, and whenever the police responded, they did so harshly. One macabre incident was recalled on Jacob Rice. We have seen in New York a boy shot down by a policeman for the heinous crime of playing football in the street on Thanksgiving Day. So this cops shooting kids is nothing new. And that was a white kid. On election nights, it was an accepted tradition for city youngsters to build huge bonfires from the wood they collected in their neighborhoods. In one incident, the entire frame house was carried away piecemeal and burned. The police stood by dazed as the sky shone lurid all over town. Summertime brought the young crowded to the dock areas in the hopes of catching a cool breeze, but taking a swim was a crime, for which these unlucky enough to be caught by the police were sent to prison for swimming. Henry Berg, the founder of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, once remarked that children needed to be taken out of bondage by an emancipation movement akin to that which liberated the slaves. That's what I tell you about the life of the working class white people. It was as bad and many times worse than the blacks. No doubt the framers of the Constitution did not intend it, but the gun became the integral part of America's household hardware, an all-time favorite toy of her children. Today there is a widespread disapproval of firearms, but during the Victorian period, even the most gentle families saw nothing immoral in allowing their children to play with guns, both real and the toy kind. In rural America, it was almost a rite of puberty to give a boy his own gun. Well, my dad gave me a gun when I was about 11 years old, 22 single shot Remington, and a year or so later he allowed me to get a 22 automatic, which held 20 shots. And I got pretty good with that. A lot of times I could hit a rabbit on the run. And marksmanship with a rifle and revolver was considered a highly desirable preparation for manhood. The resulting culture gave the products of Remington, Colt, and Winchester every bit the prestige of, and probably even greater popularity than those of Walt Whitman or Mark Twain, especially among the boys. See, that's what people don't understand. This desire to have guns is inbred into the American people. It's been going on a long time, and they're not going to get rid of it. Leisure requires change, and protected green acreage offers vital relief to people overwhelmed by concrete. In the old days, however, such relief did not exist for the masses of the city residents. In 1870s, in Lower Manhattan, where most of the people lived, there was hardly a park worthy of the name. Central Park was far uptown, inaccessible to those for whom it would have been most beneficial. The Central referred to its location on Manhattan. In fact, it was 4 miles north of the population center in 1870 when the city had roughly 900,000 residents. When Oliver Wendell Holmes visited the city, he praised the park but complained that it had cost him $4 to come uptown from 23rd Street and 25th Avenue. Obviously, the poor could not afford the horse car fare. Indeed, it was said that for the mass of the people, the park might have been 100 miles away. too distant even for an annual outing. A teacher asked 50 slum children in 1873 how they liked Central Park, learned to his surprise that only three had ever visited it. The park's location reflected no discredit on its creator, Frederick Law Olmsted, and those lucky enough to have access to it were rewarded by its pleasant walks and tranquil beauty. However, even then, the fear of crime troubled both park commissioners and visitors. From the beginning, speculators who wanted the ground for building lots opposed the planned park on the grounds that it would become a hangout for gangsters and ruffians who would rob decent citizens and drive them out of their bawdy antics. And they were not entirely wrong. The park became a refuge for loafers, bums, and thieves, who, while not the most dangerous criminal types, made its visitors apprehensive. Olmsted expressed concern about these dangers in his 1870 report of the Parks Commission. Quote, "Difficulty of preventing ruffianism and disorder was from the first the greatest the commission met, and the means of overcoming it cost more study than all the other things. Bums and drunks were a constant annoyance, preempting benches that were intended for the self-respecting toilers, the working class. Although the police made numerous arrests, as many as 40 in one morning, the nuisance never disappeared, and the park visitors wandered through its dales and tunnels with less than comfortable feelings." The sinister-looking denizens created a climate of fear that was responsible as much as crime itself for Olmsted's recommendation in 1882 that the park be closed after dark. Nothing came of it because of the impracticality of trying to lock up an 84-acre plot, despite the police warning that at night there was an excellent chance of being garroted or robbed. Further handicaps, and like I told you before earlier on, that was the case clear up into the 50s and maybe still is, when I took a girl walking in Central Park and the cops stopped us and told us, "You better not go in there, you're liable to get beat up or robbed or raped." So we didn't go in there. Further handicaps to pleasure were imposed by park officials themselves. Visitors were regimented rather ponderously, as if the park was a place to be viewed rather than used. Warnings to keep off the grass were strictly enforced. Games and sports were frowned upon as they interfered with the refined pleasure of the landscape watching. Perhaps the best known enclosed space in America, Central Park, remained as it was in the good old days, alternately a focus of pleasure and apprehension, but crucially an indispensable source of relaxation. Seaside leisure. The day's outing in the Gilded Age was seldom launched on impulse. Instead, it was plotted far in advance like a minor campaign. For city residents, about two-thirds of the population, getting out to the countryside or seashore was a considerable nuisance. It also entailed expenses that a working-class family could not readily afford. Even in the 1860s, when open country was full at hand, the New York Journal observed, quote, "There is a real moral hedonism in the way some people attend picnics. They carry enormous baskets. They pack themselves into stages three deep, or wedge themselves into cars, or stand in the burning sun of the decks of steamboats." For New Yorkers, the seashore provided the biggest lure. New Jersey's Long Beach attracted the well-to-do, Coney Island the masses. Before the opening of the Bay Ridge streetcar line, it took 2.5 hours by horse car, ferry, and boat to travel from city to Coney Island. I know, I went from Manhattan out to Coney Island. It took me a long time, and that was in the 50s. The round trip cost $2 per person. A locker for changing, not permitted elsewhere, cost 50 cents. with queues 2 and 3 blocks long at peak season. But even more disagreeable than the time, the cost, or crowding was the condition of the beach itself. It was polluted. Polluted because New Yorkers used the waterways surrounding the city as dumping grounds for garbage, and much of this settled on the closer shoreline. The river dumping platforms were discontinued in 1872, but the new method, using dumping barges, proved even more detrimental to beach cleanliness. In 1898, the erstwhile street cleaning commissioner admitted that the city's garbage defiled the beaches in an intolerable degree. Similarly, the Jersey Shore was littered for miles with boxes, cans, straw, and other accumulated junk. No doubt there were thousands of miles of pristine beach, but this was quite irrelevant to people who couldn't reach them. It was an irony typical of the period. Pollution overhead, garbage underfoot, streets choked with traffic, bursting slums, crime, labor unrest, dope addiction, problems of the future in the country with a future. Perhaps the Victorians' obsession with success left little room for compassion. There you go. Perhaps their pursuit of happiness left little time for pleasure. Perhaps indeed their nostalgia more rightly belonged to them as they cast a sad eye on the lowering sky and longing for the good old days. And that's the end of the book. Left you with right at the end with a picture of people on the beach trying to sun themselves on the beach, but the water was full of garbage and dead cats and dogs. So there you go. The good old days, they were terrible. By Otto L. Bettman. So every time your kids get to griping and moaning, there's nothing to do, have them read this book. Well, you need to get a plane ticket real fast, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Presidential candidate Donald Trumpy and his Trumpettes will travel to the U.S.-Mexican border Thursday and meet with local citizens and some yokel citizens, too. And law enforcement in Laredo, Texas. Well, there you go. Trump's Get Tough plan is going to be revealed. Wow. Oh, did you see that the military is appealing to these wingnut guys that are showing up to protect the military recruiting offices? Tell them, please go home. You get a look at some of these guys that are showing up, big fat tubs. Oh, man. Well, it's really weird. So here you got Yahoo's right-wingers, I guess, showing up to defend the recruiting office that's recruiting young white men to go over and get their ass blown off, occupying another country that's not their own, and shooting people in the country. And so these guys are showing up to protect those people. The killers. Showing up to protect the killers. I'm telling you, this country has gotten so screwed. It's unbelievable. On the news break that they're showing about this Donald Trump going down to the border, and right under Trump's Get Tough plan revealed is a sentence that says, "One thing you should do for your prostrate every morning." Turn on Newsmax. It'll get better. You know, these black Klansmen just can't get any respect. Michael Turner, black Mr. Michael Turner, considers himself a hero for chasing down a mentally ill man who stabbed his friend in the shoulder for no reason. Target, however, claims that the 2013 incident would not have occurred had it not been for the actions of Turner and his three friends on that day. Turner, along with his friends Job Wright, Ronald Smith, and Tyreek Walker, are getting sued by Target Oh, that's funny. Well, Flint, Michigan. Isn't that where our movie maker bowling at Columbine guy lived? Flint? April the 5th. No, April V. Taylor. Michigan is surrounded by the Great Lakes, which accounts for 20% of the world's fresh surface water. This causes many people to assume that it's clean, safe water, and it's readily available to the state's residents at an affordable cost. However, the cities of Detroit and Flint prove otherwise, and they got a problem with the water. What does it say here? Somebody said water in Flint, Michigan, causing the hair to fall out and rashes. Wow. Now, Flint, Michigan has some of the highest water and sewer rates in the country, with an average household incurring $150 monthly charges. Price isn't the only issue in Flint. In April 14, the city's emergency manager changed the source of the city's drinking water from Detroit's system to the Flint River. The move was supposed to save residents money, but the savings has come at the expense of residents' health. One of the first issues to arise was evidence of E. coli and other bacteria, which led to three separate boil water advisories. Next 9 months, residents were faced with dangerously high of a total of trihalomethane and carcinogen byproduct of chlorine, and high levels are a violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But they're still feeding it to them in Flint. Of course, you know that about two-thirds or better of the city of Flint is Negroid. I guess they're wanting to get rid of those Negroid people. Come on, Rasses, drink the water. I wouldn't lie to you. You know that. I love you. Oh, boy, those police are getting better all the time. Family begs for answers after black teenager killed by Memphis cop who thought he was somebody else. Darius Stewart was shot and killed by Memphis police officer Connor Schilling in a case of mistaken identity. Schilling pulled the car Stewart was riding in over for a headlight that was not working, and Stewart was placed in the back of Schilling's car over several outstanding warrants that were for someone other than Stewart. But things got a hand and the cops shot him, man. They shot that boy. Well, it seems the U.S. soldiers are going down to Colombia and harassing and raping and pillaging the girls down there. I wonder who most of these soldiers are. You think they're white? Yeah, it could be, but I have a feeling they're black, so let's listen to this, okay?
But the article that I think you saw, Blind to Latin America, it was actually a two-part article. The first one was written after there was reporting done in English in Colombia by a news outlet called Colombia Reports. And they were talking about a historic report that had been put out by the Colombian government that sort of glossed over the fact that there were these allegations that many, 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 many women and children were being raped by American soldiers and American agents, you know, contractors and things like that, in Colombia. And so the person who is at Colombia Reports, the editor, sort of wrote this up hoping to get more attention onto it so that people would report about it, and nobody did. It's sort of like, okay, the Colombian government put this report out and sort of, you know, everybody sort of just shrugged their shoulders about these allegations. So he was able to contact somebody in the military who said that they would look into it, but he kind of got a flat response. So he had actually gone onto a news program called On the Media and talked about how we have this blind spot to Latin America, which, you know, we really do. From my reporting, from my experience, it has just happened to be that the last, I don't know, five or six presidential tours to Latin America were overshadowed by some sort of scandal here in the U.S. or something that was happening. Every time that, for instance, President Obama has been in Latin America, the questions have been about, you know, something that happened somewhere else in the world something completely unrelated. And there's reporting, oh, the president went to Latin America, he talked to these presidents, and they're going to try to work together. And it's always very sort of, yeah, he went and talked to them. Just the U.S. news media has a blind spot to Latin America because it's big. You know, it covers this wide area. Some of it doesn't even speak Spanish. It's a very difficult area to sort of get your arms around. A lot of people, non-Hispanic people, don't have like this strong connection to Latin America. So it's just a really difficult place to report on. Although we have a lot of vested financial interests in Latin America, we have a lot of aid that we give them. We have a lot of money that we give them to increase their security. We've got a lot of issues related to migration and drugs and all kinds of things like that that we really should be paying more attention to. So that's kind of why I wrote that first article. The second article was sort of saying, hey, it turns out that the historian that wrote that research paper for the Historic Commission in Colombia basically made these allegations up out of whole cloth, and there wasn't anything to them. So there were other things that have been reported in Colombia that were crimes against women and children perpetrated by Americans on Colombian soil. And of course the promises are always that they'll be looked into, but you know, just coming back to this idea that we don't have a mechanism for really going on, knowing what's going on over there and having the resources to put news bureaus in places and key places in Latin America where they can respond to these sorts of allegations or news in a very nuanced, contextual way that will really be able to suss out some of the negatives from the positives, some of the untruth.
Well, anyhow, there you go. We got American troops, U.S. troops. I don't know what percentage of them are white or non-white or what. And then plus all the contractors going down there and raping these little girls and things like that. Isn't that wonderful? How we're represented overseas? Strange. Well, I told that black KKK they better get to recruiting more people because Compton, California was once the mostly black area in California. But now there are violent Mexican gangs there and Central Americans who've declared certain areas off limits to blacks. If black families move into what the Latino gangs declare to be their city, then the blacks are driven out by being intimidated or beaten. Gee, wonder what that's all about. Couldn't be race, could it? The Los Angeles Police Department says there have been attacks on several black families over the last decade, most of them by Mexican gangs. Los Angeles Times details one such attack. A black family, a mother of three teenage children and a 10-year-old boy, moved into a little yellow home in Compton. When a friend came to visit, four men in a black SUV pulled up and called him a nigger, saying black people were barred from the neighborhood. According to Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies, they jumped out, drew a gun on him, and beat him with metal pipes. Compton has a population of about 90,000 and was predominantly black for many years. It is now 65% Mexican and 33% black, according to the 2010 U.S. Census. And the Mexican and South American gangs intend on keeping the city mostly Latino. Latino law enforcement officials say the attacks on black families has been being ordered by the Mexican Mafia prison gang. Leaders of Azusa 13 gang were sentenced to lengthy prison terms earlier this month for leading a policy of attacking African-American residents and expelling them from town. Similar attacks have taken place in Harbor Gateway, Highland Park, Pacoima, San Fernandino, Canoga Park, and Wilmington, among other places. Many African-Americans are leaving the city because they don't want to be targeted by gangs. Well, they've been leaving the city for a couple of decades, And now it's really getting to be interesting. So the, but the black KKK, they're more worried about the cops than they are the Latinos. So we'll see how that goes. Here's a couple of letters based on that last article. Funny how there's not one mention of the term racism in this article. Why? Because racist is a term reserved for white people only. People of color are not capable of being racist. This is a simple misunderstanding. If these were white gangs, you can bet your ass this would make national headlines and the articles would be littered with accusations of white people being inherently evil and racist, because that is established narrative pushed by the media to guilt white America into giving our country away cheap foreign labor. Same story in Canada, Britain, Europe, and Australia. Black Americans, if you think Latinos are your friends, I've got some bad news for you. Here's a note from the opposite. We need those Latino mestizo gangs here in New Jersey to protect us. There's a lot of blacks here. Next one. Well, Houston and Dallas have bad gangbangers compared to Orange County and San Diego. I hear all these conservatives say how great Texas is. Houston and Dallas have about three times the gang banging of Santa Ana and Anaheim, or San Diego and Houston and Dallas have too many mestizos and blacks, so they get into gangs. Anaheim, Santa Ana, and San Diego have few blacks. Well, I don't believe that. Well, let's see here. What else we got? Another one of those letters from Mustafa. Chi-town, stand up, black people, stand up, wake up, or be done up. We as an ancient and old bloodline are warriors by birth, but fear runs very strong in us. But here in Chicago, we don't have that problem because most of us get along until the gang-banging thing kicks off. And I must say, it's not pretty. Black folks here kill each other. And the best believe Mexican folk don't mess around, believe that we ain't going anywhere unless we want to. I have to tell you who the Olmecs are of Mexico. They sure do look black to me. Mexicans must be taught that Mec and Tec means black. Mexico is the big land of the black people. Texas is the little land of the black folk. So if they both mean black, how are they yours? You think you like to claim Maya, she's also black, her father's Zeus, the jet black god, the Olmecs, were there first, not Aztecs. There's that Tech again. Read and learn that we're family, not enemies, but fighting us you want and will not win, plain and simple. That was pretty hard to read. Pretty hard to read. Well, old General Wesley Clark, retired, is getting a little rambunctious here, calling for concentration camps for American people. Let's hear what he's got to say.
That you reap what you sow. So how do we fix self-radicalized lone wolves domestically?
Well, we've got to identify the people who are most likely to be radicalized. We've got to cut this off at the beginning. There are always a certain number of young people who are alienated. They don't get a job, they lost a girlfriend, their family doesn't feel happy here. Mm-hmm. And we can watch the signs of that, and there are members of the community who will reach out to those people and bring them back in and encourage them to look at their blessings here. But I do think on a national policy level, we need to look at what self-radicalization means, because we are at war with this group of terrorists. They do have an ideology. In World War II, if someone supported Nazi Germany at the expense of the United States, we didn't say that was freedom of speech. We put him in a camp. They were prisoners of war. So if these people are radicalized and they don't support the United States and they're disloyal to the United States as a matter of principle, fine, that's their right. It's our right and our obligation to segregate them from the normal community for the duration of the conflict. And I think we're going to have to increasingly get tough on this, not only in the United States, but our allied nations like Britain and Germany and France are going to have to look at their domestic law procedures.
General Wesley Clark, as always, great to see you, sir. Thanks for your time, and I want to pass along
to
our viewers.
Very interesting, huh? Very interesting from a retired general. Yeah. He doesn't know his history very well because there was an anti-war group in the United States all through the war, and many pro-German people were still giving speeches and talking after the war, all during the war, so they weren't all rounded up and put in concentration camps either. I got so excited I clipped off my recording here, and I started another little one, so I'm going to be sending you two of them out here today. Isn't that something? General Wesley Clark. Can't trust those generals, man. Can't trust the politicians either. Remember, General Wesley Clark was the commander at Fort Hood who sent the military equipment to Waco, Texas that was used to incinerate the men, women, and children of a harmless religious community. He also showed a proclivity for attacking civilian targets, schools, hospitals, and markets during Clinton's illegal war against Yugoslavia. Now he wants to set up internment camps in the U.S. for dissidents. Well, you try it, General, and see what happens to your white ass. And that's it for today, boys and girls. Let's see, tomorrow's Thursday. I may just be running a regular historical show tomorrow. We'll see what happens, all right? 14-5. And watch out for the General. Don't forget, Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, ran for president the last time around. Whoopee.